You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
So my name's Stephen Weir. I'm a community engagement person. I'm a bit of a place nerd, and I run a pretty new consultancy called Amplifier. And it's a real pleasure to be asked to come along and support Urban Design Forum and to celebrate the work that they've been doing around Place for Protagonist. Urban Design Forum is a not-for-profit organisation who supports public interest in supporting great cities. We believe that the role of cities can play a huge challenge in solving the major problems of our time. So just to give you a bit of a heads up about what the conversation is about tonight, we're celebrating stories about Naarm, about Melbourne, about the city, and we're celebrating how these narratives can and still be used around the evolution of the role of the city as it changes. There's so many places in the city that hold really special memories for people across Melbourne, Naarm, and the changes that have been encountered in the city in the last 30, 40 years and what's to come in the next 30, 40 years is quite dizzying. But it gives us a chance at the moment to stop and reflect about what makes it special up until this point and what can make it special in the future. This government that we're having Victoria at the moment have committed to investing a lot in things like housing and infrastructure, which means that there will be huge changes. So this gives us an opportunity today to think about how we might actually celebrate what's gone before and celebrate the stories that have happened around place. Some of the things we want to think about is what does it mean to think about memory of a place? How do we ensure that our First Nations voices are prioritised and their perspectives celebrated? How do we make sure that lesser-known voices are heard? As somebody who works in community engagement, that's particularly important for myself. And how do we think about these rapid changes that the city's going through and how we can actually think about how we can collectively capture those and make the city even better into the future? So tonight we're going to do a couple of things. There's going to be some stories by our great panelists that are sitting next to me here, but you will have all been given a QR code at the start, which frames the night around the fact that there's been an interactive crowdspot map that's been live for a while, that's been encouraging people across the city to post a pin in the map and talk about a story, a narrative, something that's happened to them in the city, and the role that that place has played in that story itself. I think, you know, if you have had a chance to look at those stories so far, it's been intriguing to see how people have actually started to tell their stories. There's a lot in there about memories of people just landing and wanting to tell stories about a particular moment in their lives, like where there was a proposal or where there was something that really quite shook their lives in a particular moment in time. And others is just like fleeting reactions to actually being in a particular place at a particular time. I posted a story on there last week, which was about a place called the Miami Motor Inn in West Melbourne on Hawke Street. My story was, this was my first stop upon arriving in Australia for the first time. The first long jet-lagged sleep, the first taste of Vegemite, and it was a firm no. Very briefly, my first home base while I settled in for a semester at university. It was the starting place for inner city exploring and a general upending of my idea of Australianness. But one of the stories that I read that really, really struck a chord for me today was it was posted by somebody called Blackhat. And it was a story of sadness and love about sitting on the steps of the GPO building in the CBD. I'll just read it. I made my last phone call to my father at this spot on a cold, sunny winter afternoon. I took him on a virtual tour of CBD streets while he was on a hospital bed with COVID. It gave him so much joy. He passed a day later, and I've not seen him for 4 years. This place will always be memorable to me for the very intimate and personal reasons. And you can't help but think about how that place, the GPO, held such a powerful space for somebody to be communicating with someone in their family. Now I just want to take a moment to introduce our panelists who are going to be telling us special stories that connect them to NAM. Each of our speakers here will share a short story, and then we'll have a chance to reflect and discuss on what we've learned from them and their stories about place. And hopefully we'll have some time for a quick Q&A with the audience at the end. I'll just do the quick introductions to who's here, and then I'll hand over to each of them to have their moment of fame. First off is Joy Zhu, who is a transdisciplinary artist and design practitioner based in Melbourne, whose practice draws on embodied experience to communicate complex intersectional relations. Her practice expands on their background in interior design, and Joy works with immediate contexts. Next along, we have Michael Trudgeon, who is a founding design director at Crowd Productions, a Melbourne-based design studio focused on creating and curating customer and staff experiences in physical space. He's a professor of design at the School of Design at RMIT and a coordinator of the Master of Design Innovation Technology and Major Projects Program. And last but not least, Genevieve Callahan is a writer and performer based in and on Wurundjeri country. In her work, she often attempts to capture some aspect of the transient and to convey it. Her debut anthology, One Story a Day, is not just a collection of stories, questions, and ponderings, but an illuminating insight into the operational ritual and persistence. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Joy, and let's begin hearing your story. Thank you.
Hello. Hi, everyone. My name is Joy, and thanks, Stevie, for the introduction. So I've been living on the Wurundjeri country for about 10 years as a visitor coming from China. And I also like to pay my respect to the ancestors and elders past and present and extend my respect to the First Nations people that are present today. The stories I'm sharing today comes from a public art project that I did about a year ago, which is about the underground waterway that is running underneath the city. The project was called The Creek Chat, and it was a sound-based public art intervention. And it's coming from my own visitor's perspective, which coming into the city, I didn't know anything about it until a day I discovered there's a waterway that is running underneath the place that I've been on like for a really long time. So I create this sound composition, I guess, to invite audience to, I guess mostly incidental audience in the public space in the city to listen to this audio as they, alongside another layer of the present city noise that is surrounding us, and almost like a reimagining what if this creek is still running today, what it would sound like. So today, I guess my story is like an audio story, and I'm going to share a 5-minute excerpt of this story. And before playing that audio, I guess I would like to invite everyone to be the listener of the story, which the idea of sound and listening was something that was really interested. That listening is not just hearing something that's happening, but it's like paying attention and being more attentive to things that is happening around you, and understand where they come from, I guess. So, yes.
Thanks, Joy. That was beautiful. And so, remarkably evocative, sitting here with little water noise behind us, you know, in our concrete box, thinking about being under Elizabeth Street. Thank you. Now we might pass over to Michael, who's going to take us back to heady days of clubbing and general outrageousness in the 80s in Melbourne.
What I'm going to talk about actually is, so Joy, thank you for that presentation. What I find extraordinary about Melbourne is the way that place here is created by people. So my experience of Melbourne in terms of the idea of a city full of extraordinary possibilities began at the very end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s. I was sharing a house with my friend Ramesh from school in Brunswick Street in Fitzroy. We had a three-story hotel that was empty. It had been a fairly infamous venue, even a nighttime venue called Marijuana House. You can imagine what it was like. So we had a three-story hotel. We had apartments and bathrooms on the top floor. In the middle floor, we had basically an entire, not quite a dance venue, but a pub, a live band venue where we could rehearse music. On the ground floor, we had an industrial kitchen where we could invite up to 40 people over for dinner. And I believe Ramesh might correct me here, but let's say we were paying something like $30 a month in rent. Now, the reason why I mention all this is that at that particular time in Melbourne, I mean, Melbourne was a true donut city in that sense. Anyone who could had escaped to Kew and beyond. So if you had the wherewithal and a good education and some income, you'd be moving to Doncaster. So that meant that the guts of the city was very, very empty. Now, obviously, there were lots of people involved at that time in the city starting to think about how to regenerate it. And obviously, the work that was being done by Melbourne City Council in reimagining the opportunities for the centre of the city were really, really critical in the work of Rob Adams and his team. But we were in Fitzroy and we were living in a suburb that was completely empty except for the possibilities of what it could become. Very, very close to an enormous range of resources, but no competition for space. And we watched, I guess, a whole lot of empty warehouses and shops, many of which had been brothels probably for at least a decade, gradually become inhabited by artists, musicians, writers, cafes and restaurants. And I think what this did for me was create the idea that a city was about possibilities. And while the notion of place is very critical, this is kind of almost a political place because this is a place where there was plenty of space to live, but no one wanted to live here. And that meant that it was incredibly cheap, which means that people who had very little money but wanted space could move in. Warehouses are a fantastic collateral for very experimental activity. And so, in a way, at that particular time, life just felt so incredibly rich because Joy might be next door and she might have a space that's like a warehouse where you're doing this kind of work on a weekly, a monthly basis, and we're all turning up every other week with beers to listen to the latest thing that you've done. That's an extraordinary experience you can have within a kind of urban context. I'm going to say that my experience has said to me that these are kind of uniquely urban experiences in the sense that the amenity, the accommodation provided by cities, and in this case, in Fitzroy, we're talking old pubs and warehouses, not necessarily dwellings, that they are readily convertible to an enormous range of activities. And when people move in who are interested in creative enterprise, they start to build another phenomenon, a kind of creative city, a city of experimentation and expression. For me, that's what makes cities remarkable. And I guess that's why I'm not living in the outer suburbs and I'm not particularly interested in living in the country. And I want to be in a place where there are lots of other people. I mean, I know there are lots of people who'd like to not have lots of people around them, but I think the experience of living in Melbourne and living in Fitzroy particularly brought home that given the opportunity for a whole lot of people to get together where there was enough space for creative experimentation, there was no limit to the possibilities of what was going to happen next. And it made for a remarkably exciting life. And I guess I would just like to put that out there, that that is something that I think was really quite unique in Melbourne. I think it went from being a kind of a city that almost had been cast aside to a city that became an international capital. And maybe that's sort of a rather romantic view of Melbourne. At the moment, Wendy Lassiter and I are looking at the idea with a Turning Circle project, thinking about, is there a way using COVID as a kind of, as a starting point and the impact it will ultimately have on values in the city to try and bring something like that back again? So I guess that's another lesson in all of this. With what one has learned and experienced from place, are there ways you can take that forward to try and think about how you might create a set of similar possibilities again? So I think for me, the whole idea of place is very much about people, but it's also very dynamic. It's not static. It's about movement, people moving through, time moving on. I'll finish on that.
Thank you, Michael. Great food for thought there, especially the conversation about post-COVID and property in the city and whether we do have that opportunity now. Last of our panelists is Genevieve, who is going to tell us a short story.
I'm going to read a couple of very short stories.
Love it.
So I've probably picked out too many. Better to have too many than not enough, but I'll try and stick to my 5 minutes. So I published this book in 2022, One Story a Day, and it was originally an Instagram account, and I wrote a story every day for 1,001 days. They all had to be short enough to fit on an Instagram screen. And so I'll read you some of the Melbourne-specific stories. There are a lot of Melbourne-specific stories, but these were some that I thought would be appropriate for today. Verse 60, rooms. The Brunswick warehouse bedroom 2 years before it was demolished. The big room in North Fitzroy, where we left the window open all night and fell asleep to the werewolf. The Yarraville front room beside an alley where a local woman with Tourette's syndrome would walk and curse every night. The room in the pink and blue Collingwood house with tilting floors. The Carlton room on the third floor where we sat naked in the storm on the terrace on New Year's. Verse 287. Good. I'm 8 years old and we've taken our fish and chips to the Fitzroy Gardens. Mum scans for a good spot. She finds one. We descend upon it. A blanket is shaken and lain and pulled flat. The bundles of chips ripped open, blotted with sauce and lemon. Coke is poured and the ready black fizz barely has time to hiss into our plastic cups before we demand more. Verse 325, a walk through East Melbourne, fantasy suite. Stand in people's gardens, pass freshly washed men in soft jumpers, run a dry finger along every polished bonnet, pull one leaf from each easily accessible tree, note roses, rank warnings, see grim bowls of flowers standing stark on tables in windows. Hold one word in your mind and repeat it. Verse 327, wind, pollen, song. A big wind blows along Bourke Street, and as it sends glittering pollen through the air, a homeless woman starts to sing. Verse 334, midday in the gardens. A young but very frail-looking man rides his motorised scooter over to a park bench, hauls himself from the scooter to the wooden seat, rifles through a bag, finds what he's looking for, lights it with a match, looks around, sucks the hell out of his joint. Verse 339, a point on the way. There's a point on the way that I like to take to the cafe that brings me to a point where the houses on each corner look like houses from a Russell Drysdale painting. And when I reach that point, I like to pause for a moment and pretend I am in the Russell Drysdale picture that used to hang on my grandparents' lounge room wall, because there are fewer and fewer opportunities to feel close to my grandparents these days. Verse 349, no good reason. The train pulls out of Flinders Street Station, rolls to the bridge, passes the water, streets, office windows, sky, people, the sun, going. Cindy inhales and finishes her thought on the exhale. I want to be loved for no good reason. Verse 359, young woman reading on the tram. A young woman sits opposite me on the tram, gets a book out of her bag. It's The Grapes of Wrath, greatly thumbed and almost finished. Everything in me dissolves into soft light. I want to take her hand in my hand. Verse 386, a palm tree in the yard of a plumbing goods wholesaler. I am a palm tree in the yard of a plumbing goods wholesaler in Footscray. Another kind of tree has, at some point, settled into some dirt caught in my trunk, and now it is flourishing. I don't know what kind of plant it is, though. Verse 552, the tram as a capsule of peace. Sometimes, when I am on the tram at night, I want to ask the driver to turn all the lights off so we can all sit nicely in the dark and see the buildings without interference and travel darkly in a capsule of peace. Verse 643, Fitzroy Pool. A pubescent boy swims up behind a woman resting on the side of the pool. Mum, he urges in a husky voice, Mum, I need a haircut. Verse 645, on Russell Street. A beautifully dressed woman emerges from a hotel, garments fluttering in the wind. An ordinarily dressed woman walking by stops to look. The beautifully dressed woman gets into a waiting car. The ordinarily dressed woman keeps walking, a dreamy smile on her face. Verse 900, just as well. The man is so ancient, his skin has the desiccated transparency of a cicada shell, and when he shuffles into the carriage, he stares ahead, listless, muttering. The train begins to move again, and he gingerly lowers himself into the seat. We reach Rosanna Station, and just before the train departs, a muscular young man, radiant with health, bounds across the platform and dives through the closing carriage doors. The ancient man roars with delight. Just as well, you're in good nick. He wheezes and the two men share a hearty laugh. Verse 983, in the cancer hospital cafe. People in scrubs, people in beanies and headscarves, people in Santa hats and elf ears, faces gaunt with illness, faces grey with worry, faces taut with amplified cheerfulness. At a table near the door, two elderly women sip their cappuccinos and take small, mindful bites of their sandwiches. No doubt about it, the one in lilac says after a period of silence. If you sit here long enough, you see a lot. And there's one more piece that I'm going to read that's not from the book, but I wrote it recently and it felt appropriate for today, thinking about linking place. So not just our place, but other places, from Peel Street to Smith Street to Victoria Street. The sweet gabble of magpies outside my window, talking like hyperactive children who are excited because the weather's nice. The beautiful ratios of the young man's shoulder width to waist circumference as I walk behind him up Peel Street. He stops at the bubbler to drink. The sky today, magnificent, the heat. The yell hello from Rochelle as I near Oxford Street. We compliment each other's outfits. The dread that is withering the world as we see grey babies pulled from rubble in Gaza. The impulse in me to shriek, no, it's a mistake, the baby is alive. until its blank body flops so wrongly and the animal part of me knows no. The two nurses eating burgers in the shade of a tree on a traffic island in the middle of Victoria Street. I want to say, good on you girls, but I don't. I want to make every person who comes near me feel good. I want to make every place I go be better, but I can't and I don't. There's no space between a baby and a burger in a world as absurd as this. I keep heading over Victoria Street to the Fitzroy Gardens, where I will think about Ash.
Those are beautiful, Genevieve. Thank you so much. And thanks for sharing that new story. That was gorgeous. We might just settle in for a little bit of Q&A with you all. The first question is quite a broad one, but I think it's really important because there's really different perspectives around telling stories about place that are sitting right here. And I'll maybe start with you, Joy. Why do you think the act of storytelling about place is important?
I guess it's like acknowledging that things are, that things were already existed. And yeah, like I guess coming as from the visitor's perspective, if we don't hear this kind of story, I would if no one tell the story, I would never know about what's happened. Like I would never know about the underground waterway that existed. And I guess it's happened after that I starting to pay more attention to the drain, to the manholes basically, and looking into even like different types of manholes in the city and where they lead. And then I guess also going through research, a lot of people are actually trying to revitalize that or like bringing that creek back to life. So there's a lot of people trying to change something. And yeah, I guess it's like through storytelling, and we pass on stories from someone to me and me to someone else. It's kind of like it's like a collective gesture to share like what it's already, what had been here. And yeah, it's an acknowledgement, I guess.
Genevieve, I might throw to yourself and the same question, but I suppose also like, you know, what is it that motivates you to make place such an important part of your own storytelling process?
For me, it's panic. it really touches on what you've said, Joy. It's just a keen sense of how transient everything is, including place. We're more overtly transient, but place changes, borders shift, buildings fall down or knock down or... And I mean, even walking here tonight, walking through Fed Square, and I sort of vaguely remember what used to be there. And I remember at one point when they were going to build a huge Apple store there, and you're just like, wow, yeah, things are so unlasting. And so there's this, the motivation for me is usually this sort of panic to try to capture something while it exists, which, you know, is a, it's a vain attempt because, you know, everything is unlasting. But stories, I think maybe stories last the longest. I'm obsessed with mythology and I can hear some giggles from fowls in the because I'm obsessed with mythology. And I think part of it is because these are stories which wherever they're from, they're stories that are like the distillation of countless human beings repeating something to each other. And, yeah, I think our stories last more than anything. So they're a good thing to put your stocks in.
Michael, you know, knowing what you do for a living, working around design, like, is it something that fundamentally underscores your practice? Is it something that is really important for you to consider in your work every day?
Well, I mean, architecture is it is often described as being about place and identity. So in that sense, it's sort of it's built into the DNA of that particular kind of practice. As I said earlier, for me, I think the issue around the way people make place is really critical, and I think that trying to understand how, you know, that process or how it can be supported. And to Genevieve's point, this idea of storytelling and of basically taking experience and using that as the starting point for the development of what might become myths, but certainly become ways of explaining or giving character to a space or ascribing a kind of character which someone may have experienced. I think that's incredibly important. I think this has to do with the whole idea of the weight of life. And, you know, I guess coming back to this place here, that we're in Melbourne having this event and we're not in Sydney or we're not in Brisbane or we're not, you know, somewhere else. And that the place, part of the tyranny of place is like the tyranny of distance. You have to get here to be here. And so if it's too hard to get here, you're not here. And it may be too hard for a lot of people to leave, so they're still here. So there is something very significant that place can't be easily transposed for somewhere else. And we can find ways of escaping, traditionally by telling stories or by spending a lot of time on the internet or hoping for immersive 3D digital environments. So I think place has enormous weight just because of the difficulty of moving around. And so in some respects for me, place is not so much about stasis. It's not about the being static somewhere, but it's the way that you move to it, through it, and from it. And I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but I think it's something that we're forced to have to deal with. You know, it's something that at this moment we still can't effectively erase or transpose.
I think it does make sense, and one of the things that springs to mind is the concept of song lines through our First Nations communities over the years, and how the concept of storytelling is one of the reasons why we have a rich history, especially in places like Victoria where there's been so much loss. I guess a question on that then, maybe I'll start with you, Joy, on this, is around First Nations perspectives, certainly from design and architecture, that's becoming more and more prominent as a part of the process. But how do we and how should we prioritise First Nations stories if we're thinking about the wider community and the city?
I think it's like bringing First Nation people into the project that you do, build a relationship with them. That's the fundamental thing or something maybe everyone have been talking about, but it's also something really hard to do. And I guess for some stories that if they are kind of less visible, maybe like they were not that visible for a reason in a way that it's not really contributing to like productivity or some kind of hierarchy in the society, I guess. So I guess for people who are trying to prioritize that kind of story, I feel like it's almost like you need to be open to be challenged because like that's not something you get used to. And yeah, maybe the story might not be something you want to listen to. Like you might not want to know about. But yeah, you need to firstly create a space for them, make sure they feel safe, and then maybe it starts from there.
Genevieve, in terms of like the First Nations stories, like does that come into your practice in terms of when you're thinking about passing through places and what we can learn from those stories to help build a greater narrative for the city?
I feel like the first thing that I have to say is I'm always conscious that I, as an Anglo-Irish Australian, it's difficult for me to say, and it's not something that even just popped into my mind as you were speaking, Joy, was maybe there are stories that aren't for us as well. I find that I might be springing from an assumption that everyone's stories are for all of us, and maybe that's not the case. So there's that. But where stories are being shared, I guess I'm trying to engage with them, but I'm very conscious that it's not my place to be telling those stories. And sometimes I can spiral and become paranoid and think, oh, fuck, I haven't looked into this or that. And I'm like, but it's not my place to convey that story. But what is incumbent upon me, being from where I'm from and being what I am, is just to learn those stories and to leave the space to learn them. For example, the app Yalanguth, which is fantastic if anybody isn't aware of it. That's, I think it's Fitzroy specific. Maybe it goes a bit into Collingwood, but inner north, fantastic app that is all First Nations stories from around that area, ancient and and contemporary. It's a walking tour, and it's fantastic. And it, I feel like that's one immediate example that springs to mind, that's extremely accessible and puts you in place.
Michael, any reflections on your experiences of working with First Nations stories around the creation of the city? I imagine that's changed a lot, especially since those days when you were in Fitzroy in the late 70s.
Look, it has. I'd have to say, like Genevieve, it's I can only bring a kind of very abstract and very disconnected understanding to, the thinking about the idea of place and stories from a First Nations perspective. What I have been enormously fascinated by is in a tradition like Songlines, again, I think as Genevieve alludes to, it's clear that in a custodial sense, a songline is not entertainment. So it's a responsibility. So it's something that you're born with effectively, and as cultural practices, they are of course about place and they're about spirits, but they're also about movement, because they're undertaken at roughly 4.5 miles an hour, because you walk them. And so again, I find this idea, this fascinating, of place being about movement, and a practice like Songlines being actually a way of, from a religious or cultural perspective, practicing both motion and a sense of place and an acknowledgement of place in the same way. And I think there must be it suggests to me an incredibly deep correlation between these things, probably for all of us, but it's probably I can't think of any contemporary practices necessarily that exploit that or use that particular process. So I know that sounds all terribly abstract, but that to me seems like an incredibly interesting thing to reflect on.
I think that there's something in there rather than the stories themselves, but there's something deeply, you have to deeply respect how much emphasis is placed on the idea of being able to pass on the story. And I think that it's, from a Western country or Western civilization, it's maybe not as embedded in what we do and see, and that in itself is something that's worth celebrating as Australians.
Well, in fact, to Genevieve's, again, point earlier on, it's been observed by a number of people that one of the most extraordinary things about our First Nations cultures is the capacity to be able to transfer stories for up to 100,000 years that still appear to be accurate. Now, that's insane. As a story, even from the point of view of just talking about it as a storytelling practice or information and data, if you want to really abstract it out. So that's how that happens, I don't know. But that's remarkable because it's not, you know, it's obviously a very difficult thing to do.
I wanted to ask a quick question just about the map in particular. Maybe you've all had a chance to have a look at some of the posts that have been on there so far, but one of the things I noticed that was a very inner city response that we've had from participants so far. And I guess my question is, you know, like, is the story of Melbourne for Melburnians very much about the central city, CBD? And how do we actually think about ways to prioritise places and stories from the outer suburbs where there's obviously a lot of rich stories and history there? You know, how do we make sure that those voices aren't lost as the city continues to grow? Maybe you say that, Genevieve.
It's really funny. Right before I came here tonight, my brother came to my place and I was telling him about this evening. And then he was like, who goes to that sort of thing? And I was like, well, it's for everybody, blah, 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 blah. And then he was like, no, really, who do you expect to be there? I said, probably like inner city sort of left wing-ish, arty design, you know, educated. Like, so already, you know, and that's not to poo-poo any of this, like, but it's like, you can have something that's made and then you say, oh, this is open to everyone. But if they don't know about it, then they're not going to take part in it. And it, that's the tricky part is like, how do you tell people this is available and encourage people to use it? So that's sort of the big dumb answer from my angle is like, tell people about it and tell them to use it. I mean, having said that, it makes sense and it sort of touches on something that you'd said earlier, Michael, is I'd say generally speaking, writers, artists generally flock to the city. And so I think it's not confounding that most of the stories come from the city. And I'm making a generalization here, but I feel like it'd be by and large pretty true. I think invitation and encouragement and councils, having initiatives that actively invite people to share their stories, that's one idea.
Michael, any reflections on that? Like who would be a great partner for a project like this to help really bring in a richness of stories from outside the CBD?
Well, I think, again, it comes down to the kinds of things that that generate stories and that get people inspired to tell stories and to remember things and to want to remember things. And in some respects, firstly, Melbourne is a radial city, so all the cities tend to lead to the centre. So that means that the centre is the easiest place to get to. And so I think that means that people from everywhere come into the centre of the city, so the chances that it will somehow the feature in their lives is greater. The second factor is that because we're not really an incredibly effective polycentric city, most of the stuff that goes on in the rest of the city that's not in the CBD is kind of either sleeping or maybe, you know, very, very basic retail. So there probably aren't a series of incredibly exciting or unusual activities going on that are likely to, again, stimulate stories. So, and that might be a terrible generalization and a simplification of what's going on. But people are going to remember the birth of their first child in a hospital in Ivanhoe or, you know, various life-changing events. But if what we tend to do in lots of other places except in the centre of town is shop for basic goods and sleep, then it's not providing a really strong platform for incredibly intriguing and exciting stories.
Can I jump in there? Because I feel like I'm from one angle, yes, and yet I want to hear that story, even what you just told me then. Like, if I would love for this might sound really corny, but I really think you can make anything interesting. Like, you can make any, like, you could stop anybody on any street anywhere and ask them to tell you something, and it can be interesting, even if it is going to the shops. And because it's, if I feel like, say, if you had some kind of invitation or prompt or something anywhere, but sort of shared, to encourage people to like value their ordinary lives, and I'm talking about us and I'm talking about anybody else, to value every tiny aspect of your ordinary life, it's infinitely rich and endlessly moving. That's my little two cents I wanted to just throw in there.
I might, just before we quickly ask the audience for a couple of questions, one last question for Joy. And I guess it's about, you know, we're sitting with a group of people who are all very invested in the future of the city, but with the story that you told us today in the beautiful soundscape, who do you think you'd like to most have hear that story so that something could be made a difference for the city? Who could it be?
I guess maybe building on what Genevieve just said, like exchanger, just like someone randomly. Yeah, because I'm also really interested in that, really random encounters in everyday life. Yeah, you just wouldn't know what's going to happen. You never know who's going to see and what the stories they're going to bring in. And also just, approaching someone that they might not have a name, but their story, you never know. Like, yeah, it might be more interesting.
Thank you. We've got 5 minutes if anyone's got any questions. I've got one right here.
G'day, how are you going? Thanks so much. I'm wondering, particularly for you, Michael, about maybe how you see how Melbourne has changed since the 70s and 80s, as it's become a denser city, a bigger city, more population, higher rental prices, less cheap creative space, and maybe even the way that our creative industries generate sort of a city identity and social cohesion and inclusivity for different cultures within the city. And I wonder and worry if our sort of creative space becomes too expensive, then we can't build an identity together that brings us together in a world that's increasingly fraught with conflict and disagreement. You know, what's the difference between the 70s and 80s and now? Who's the next crowded house going to be if there's nowhere for them to rehearse?
I'll start and then pass on to Genevieve and Joy. So I have a particular take on this, which is, yeah, I'm like you, I'm really worried, because I think that, again, in terms of the role that place plays, we can have a whole lot of space which is enormously overvalued and not being effective spaces for people to be using, and that can seriously get in the way of the kind of culture that we could generate as a community. And I think that's a real worry. And then the issue becomes, well, is that from a political perspective, is that something that we collectively seek to try and remedy? But I think it's a serious issue.
I agree with you. But I'd like to add, I also think it's about getting cleverer with space and also more lateral in the approach to creating. And obviously it's easy for a writer because you can do it anywhere and it doesn't take space or anything like that. But I really do think I feel like I know so many artists, because I'm lucky to, but who have come up with all kinds of amazing, strange, intimate, awkward, unusual ways of making their work. So I think it's about adapting. I agree with you. It's awesome to have like actual physical space, but it's not a luxury that everyone can access, as you've mentioned, and it's you can't count on it. And so, but what you can count on, maybe, well, not entirely, but is your own mind. And yeah, I think it's just, it's about coming up with different solutions and help from the government.
I wonder if there is a real value on the physical space, though, because I think, you know, now we connect and create online on our personal computers, PCs, as they call them.
Crowded house and PCs.
I've just woken up from a... I've been frozen. I wonder, like, how important the physical space is, and also you spoke about one type of sort of freedom and ability to do that, but what about like the economic freedom that seems like there was in the 70s and 80s? Was that a real thing in Melbourne, or was that imagined and romanticised?
No. I think it was enormously real. But I mean, I'm interested in Joy's practice and you know, you, the way you're operating, the way you're working in today's environment, seizing your space.
Yeah, I don't know much about the economic space. I guess I'm interested in that relational space. Maybe also was also building on what Genevieve was saying, but also Michael. It's like working with someone, and that itself become a space. Like you help someone, and you like you help each other. But then when you have a physical space, you're responding to that space of what's the condition, even like a warehouse, an office. Like they're all really different. They built differently, like you got carpets or you got a concrete floor, and you use the space with different intent. And yeah, I guess maybe also just on what's available, like what's immediately available, and just what can you do with it. Yeah.
Big thank you from myself and to our three panelists for sharing their stories. Tonight's been really interesting. We've heard really short snippets of joy, pain, and sadness. We've heard reflections on the past and aspirations for the future of the city. And we've had a moment to indulge in the act of listening to help us think about the unseen place. I'd just like everyone to give a big round of applause, please, to the three panelists, Joy, Michael, and Genevieve.
You've been listening to an MPavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.